From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just minutes ago when the University of Rochester president, Joel Seligman, released a statement regarding some student demands. You might have seen that story. It flared up on Friday, and over the weekend, a number of students marched into his office in the area there. They were chanting, saying that they wanted some solutions to the problems as they see it regarding race on campus. They want racial inclusion policy. They want to know that students are going to be treated equitably. And they specifically targeted a social media app called Yik Yak that they say is the source for a lot of racist comments. They felt like it protects anonymity and leads to a lot of really nasty stuff. We've seen it at the University of Rochester, but they are not alone. We have seen that at Brockport and many other places across the country. The question is, can a university do something about Yik Yak? What can they do legally? What do you do with that? Well, today we wanted to bring in a couple of people who can help us understand social media from a lot of different angles. Its functionality, maybe some of the ethics, and then the legal side of things. They're here. We're going to talk about what just came down from the University of Rochester, along with a number of other stories that have included social media in the recent news. So we'll be working through a lot of different points this hour. And let me bring them in right now. Mike Johansson is a senior lecturer of communications at RIT and social media consultant at Fixitology. Mike, nice to have you back. How are you, sir?
Good to be here.
Good. And also here is Scott Maloof. He's an attorney whose practice in Rochester is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. And Scott, always great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
The news just off. You guys are reading it as we're walking into the room, just as I am, about Yik Yak. And so let me go ahead and read what I have here, and then we'll talk about what it means here. Yik Yak has agreed to geofence or disable its apps around 90% of the nation's high schools and middle schools. We know that. And they've created filters to prevent full names from being posted and to request that senders reconsider messages that contain specific keywords that are being sent. Joel Seligman says he's not satisfied that Yik Yak has been sufficiently responsible in working with the University of Rochester, and he has charged a commission to recommend by January 31st whether the University of Rochester should bar Yik Yak from use over university facilities. Mike Johansson, I know a number of our listeners are still hearing this go, wait a second, tell me again, what is Yik Yak? What is Yik Yak?
It's an anonymous social media app where you can post comments. I mean, you have to sign up for it, but you're posting anonymously under a handle. You can pretty much say whatever you want, and people have used it, I would say, a ratio of like 60 to 40, 75 to 25, to sort of vent. It's become the sort of the venting thing. It was designed for college students, but obviously people much younger than that have been using it, which is why Yik Yak has agreed to geofence things like high schools, middle schools, and so forth, because they really don't want kids that young using it.
Okay, so if you're in middle school or high school right now and you are on school grounds, you can't use Yik Yak, is that correct?
Well, the schools individually have to apply to Yik Yak to be geofenced, which essentially means cut off from Yik Yak in a small geographic area.
Okay, what do we know about most schools? Are they doing that now?
I haven't seen any stats on it. I mean, the Yik Yak says it's agreed to do this 90% thing. That's probably because those are the ones they can easily do by triangulation from cell towers. There's probably a bunch they can't do. But as the actual number that are doing it, I don't know.
Okay. And Mike, the reason this comes up, Yik Yak, so often when it comes to racist, but also sort of nasty kind of threats or pseudo threats, that kind of a thing. We've seen college professors in different states and here claim that they felt threatened because during a class, someone is making Yik Yak comments about them in really nasty, derogatory ways. We've seen students out of Brockport. In fact, a really admirable group of students came in here to talk about that. And frankly, I think the College of Brockport should be commended as well. They came right in to say, we're concerned about this. There were students who had engaged in some activism. And all of a sudden on Yik Yak, they're being told, you know, where's the lynching? You know, really, really nasty stuff there. You don't have to use your imagination to figure out what kind of racial epithets we've seen. So there's, I don't want to say that that's all Yik Yak is, but there's been enough of it that we've seen it in a lot of places. Is that fair?
Sure, sure. And that's the stuff that tends to get people upset. I mean, there's all kinds of other sexual content and people making suggestive comments and so forth. But obviously, it's the racial thing that upsets people and the threats to people upsets people the most.
All right, I want to bring in Scott Maloof. I want to listen to what some of the students marched at the University of Rochester on Friday, calling for some change. And this is what it sounded like there. And so that's that group of students there was essentially saying, you know, we want to deal with this now. We want to deal with Yik Yak. We want to have a racial inclusion policy, et cetera. And Scott Maloof, when it comes to Yik Yak, first of all, on the legal side of this, you know, immediately I saw people on Friday saying, well, what can the University of Rochester even do? Can you shut Yik Yak down? I don't know how you do that.
Well, I think that asks two questions.
Okay.
One is, can the university shut Yik Yak down itself, as in the company operating out in Georgia? The answer is no. You know, we could touch base and go deeper into the law, but that's the very short answer. But that's not really what the students are asking about. And I think that the better coverage of this has said that university students have asked for two things. One, that university facilities, the Wi-Fi networks, the servers, not allow access to Yik Yak. And then two, we've seen other groups, not the U of R students particularly, ask for monitoring of what is occurring on Yik Yak, and that the universities that they attend or colleges they attend respond to that. So if there's an individualized threat against a student or a group, that the university see that and then take physical action on the ground.
All right, so there's a couple of points there, and I'm going to work backwards. That last point you make there, let's say there's a perceived threat or really ugly stuff, and students want some action. In the past, when I've talked about Yik Yak on this program, you know, it felt sort of intractable because it was hard to trace. But Yik Yak requires at least a phone number before you sign up? Do people feel like if you talk to Yik Yak and say, hey, this person who's using your service is doing it nastily, are they actually acting? What are we saying?
I think that's the continuous stress we see with all of these kinds of sites. Reddit has had this problem. Twitter's had this problem, which is the organizations want to be as hands-off as possible because, you know, they don't know how they're going to develop in 5 years. It takes a lot of programming and human infrastructure to be hands-on. But yet, once nastier aspects bubble up, they feel that they then have to be responsive. Yik Yak is introduced, for example, reporting tools right in the app, where if you see a yak that you find problematic, you can report it to it. In their terms of service, they have been explicit to say, we do not condone racist posts. We do not condone abusive posts or individually calling out people. And so they reserve the right to knock a user off or to take posts down and things of that nature. But therein is the tension, in that it's easy to say those things, but when you have hundreds of thousands of things being posted daily, if not more, very hard to do that, especially it's a technological process. You've got a screen for words, and that's something we can get into.
And then there's also the question on if a word is still part of speech. It may not make people comfortable, but if it's, you know, I guess, do we have to distinguish between what a threat is and what simply ugly languages, you know, I mean, where does speech come in, protected speech, et cetera, Scott?
Yeah, and that's incredibly hard to do,
yeah.
Even on a human level where the three of us can look at something and see it. But remember, from their standpoint, these companies are usually very small. They don't have very large staffs, and they're using technology. Yik Yak, in its statements, has said, we're using technology that ironically you use in litigation to find relevant documents in computer. They're using that technology to find relevant words. But as humans, we evolve, and people will use that. One example is students. If you want to call out a particular student and they're on an athletic team, you may use the number. You may use their jersey number. We've seen that. And how do you scan for that? You can't say you can't use the number 31.
Mike Johansson, when it comes to what Scott described on limiting Yik Yak, you know, the student demands not just to shut it down, but to say, okay, from technology on school property, school grounds, is that just another form of geofencing?
No, they're actually two different things. So
okay.
If you're blocking it on the Wi-Fi and the servers on campus, that means you can't get it through your Wi-Fi signal, but you can still get it on a smartphone through your cellular provider. So geofencing actually blocks it off through the cellular providers by using a triangulation of the cell towers that you would normally access information on your smartphone through. So by triangulating to cell towers, you can actually block out certain areas.
Okay. And Scott Maloof, what do you make of Joel Seligman's comments? And again, it'd be easier if he's sitting here and we could have a longer conversation. And tomorrow, I'm glad to say that the University of Rochester, President Seligman's not available, but a couple of people from the administration, including Paul Burgett and the dean, is going to be on this program representing the administration, talking about the student concerns and trying to be very proactive. And I applaud them for that, and we appreciate that. So we look forward to that tomorrow. We're going to have that conversation. But when he says, President Seligman says, we're not satisfied that Yik Yak has been sufficiently responsible in working with our university, you know, I don't know exactly what he means by that. Do you?
No. And I think that's a real... I can't speak for the students or the university, but that's something that's very unclear, that as they move forward, all of us in the community would want to understand. But secondly, these technology companies, it can be incredibly difficult to work with them because they're built from the ground up to not have human interaction unless you're the kind of entity that they need to talk to. It's really hard to get a person at Yik Yak or any social media company.
Okay. Well, it sounds like, at the very least, they're pretty responsive here. And Mike Johansson, if we've seen anything, it's that people get frustrated, whether they're frustrated with Twitter for not shutting an account down that they think is, et cetera, or Yik Yak, or universities, sort of lack of responses, bad PR. And it sounds like University of Rochester is trying to move at least pretty quickly, at least signaling, we don't know exactly what we can do yet, but we care. What
do you make of that? Sure. And that's probably the best they can do at this point. You know, one of the things I like to tell people is that, you know, social media really is just sort of, not exactly the canary in the coal mine, but it's the bellwether. You know, it's out there. If the issues are out there, they will show up on social media. And dealing with the technology, that's a very small part of the equation. And it's good that, you know, President Seligman is talking about setting up a commission and talking about the much broader issue, because really that's where the work really does have to happen.
All right, listeners, we're going to move through some other subjects throughout this hour. We can circle back at any point if you want to hit certain subjects, and if you want to call in with questions or comments about this or other cases regarding social media in the news recently, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I want to move to a story that also came out just this weekend, so a lot has been happening recently. On Twitter, a New York State Assemblyman named Bill Nojay wanted to make a point about how dangerous Syrian refugees are, even the young children. And Bill Nojay tweeted a picture of a young brown-skinned boy brandishing a gun. His tweet read, quote, "When Barack Obama snickered, apparently they're scared of widows and orphans, he was thinking of this kid?" Again, it was a picture of a young boy, looked like a not much more than a toddler, brown skin, brandishing what looked like a gun. But whoops, turns out the picture was not apparently a Syrian child, and the gun was a toy, pretty obviously fake if you look at it for more than 5 seconds. Twitter flared up with commenters upset that Nojay was using a picture of a child who's not a Syrian holding a fake gun to make a point that Syrian children are likely to be armed with real weapons. Even Washington Post editor Amy Argetzinger caught wind of it and responded on Twitter, showing how easy it is to find images of American children holding real guns and looking menacing. The point was, you can Google search for anything that might help illustrate your point. It doesn't make it authentic. It doesn't make the point a good one. One person asked if Nojay was even allowed to use a photo found online in a regular Google search to spread his ideas. Now, Bill Nojay told Channel 8, their news station, last night that he didn't think he'd done anything wrong, even if it wasn't a Syrian kid, even if it wasn't a real gun, because we should still be scared of refugee children, and that was just an illustration to make a point. Others thought that was out of bounds. But let me work through this for two different ways. First of all, Mike Johansson. To me, this is just a kind of a beware of memes thing. You know, the Abraham Lincoln famously said that 80% of quotes on the internet are fake. And, you know, these memes that happen, you don't know how much you can quickly trust them, whether it's a picture, a meme, et cetera. What did this episode say to you?
Well, it's like anything. I mean, we've sort of gone, as a society, as a culture, in the 20th century, for some reason, we started to trust big media implicitly. If it came from one of the big three news networks, if it came from a big important newspaper, it must be right. We sort of shut off our natural skepticism. I think what social media is forcing us to do is go back to the days of the village square. There were people in the village square you trusted. There were people you didn't trust at all. And there were people who, frankly, were the village idiots. And that's the sort of mentality you've got to bring to social media. The people you trust, the people you don't trust. And over time, that has to build. You should approach all things that smell a little fishy, look a little fishy, treat them as being fishy. I mean, it sounds so obvious, but I got to tell you, almost a day doesn't go by when I don't see something being shared on Facebook as some news breakthrough, some big development, that I don't go to Snopes or one of the other sites that mocks, that breaks these things down and says they've researched it and it's true or it's false. There's almost not a day that goes by where I don't find somebody spreading something that's absolutely false. Now, Facebook's actually done a really good job of this. You can actually tag things. You can ask the person to take it down. You can point out this thing. And if enough of those tags show up on a particular post, Facebook will actually take it down.
Okay. Scott Maloof, on the side of what you're allowed to do, using Google search, grabbing images, using them wherever you want, what are you allowed to do?
I generally tell clients not to do that.
Not to do that?
Yeah. And the reason is because, let's break it down. when you use Twitter, you use Yik Yak, you agree to what they call the terms of service. I agree to abide by what happens here. So on Twitter, one of the things you agree to is that your content is licensed to Twitter, meaning Twitter can use it any way they want, including other users. So Mike posted a photo. It was actually your photo, I think, off the XXI site, and I retweeted that. And I felt pretty comfortable in that Mike's posted it to Twitter. But that said, Mike have the rights to, you know, that photo? He obviously didn't take it. You know, he obviously isn't the owner of it. And so that's where the conundrum lies, why I don't like Google image search and then reposting it, because you don't know what rights Mike has in the photo. And so my reusing it may expose me to a lot of problems, because Mike can grant all the rights he wants to Twitter and me as a fellow Twitter user, but if he doesn't own it, then it's a problem. And AFP got in trouble for this a few years ago.
So there's also a question, if I can jump in here.
Yeah.
So when I'm posting images to Twitter, I'm very careful, and I do completely understand what your point about it. I don't actually own the photo. I didn't take the photo of Evan, but it was an image of Evan with the Connections logo, and I'm using it in a tweet about the Connections show. Mm-hmm. I would say, with my limited knowledge of the law, that's fair use. And I'd challenge anyone to sort of take me to court over that.
Here comes Scott.
Yeah,
he just might.
Yeah. But you know, to use that same picture in a tweet about something completely different, Evan reporting about Evan's social life and then using that image, well, that's a different thing.
And that's a good point. I mean, but first of all, I'll remind you, fair use is a defense. It's
That's the defense I would use.
Yeah, you never want a defense. You want to force me to make the claim first. Yeah. But that's a really good point, in that there obviously are many fair use exceptions. You know, the educational exception, the transformative exception. For a good example is Richard Prince, the artist, has taken Instagram photos and turned them into full size portraits, and said, "This is my art." And I believe, if I recall the case correctly, he has been found, you know, not responsible for any copyright violations because he transformed what it was. And that's what makes this so difficult when we take these pictures. Mike is right. Sometimes it's okay to use it. I'm right. Sometimes it's not. The advice to folks is to say, understand where you can use the image. If, for example, U.S. government works are generally not copyrighted, so you may be able to use them in presentations or tweets without any copyright fears. But that said, there are plenty of other issues, like the right of publicity, you know, and the right of privacy. This is a great example in that the right of privacy grew up back in the 1890s. And the big threat that the justice cited when they wrote the article about this was the Kodak box camera. You know, and here was photography had been around for a long time, but Kodak had found a way to shrink it down and make it portable and take it anywhere. And that was the big risk that created this right of privacy and these rights of using images. So that's what we've always got to factor in, is how is the technology made it easy? Our version of the box camera is going to Google, copying the image and posting it.
Shutterstock, I think, is where the image might have come from. I guess that's a common market, just kind of a site online, mm-hmm. a resource mm-hmm. online to use.
Yeah, and if Mr. Nojay bought the image from Shutterstock, paid a fee for it, he owns the copyright for it, he can use it.
You know,
that'd be a good question to ask.
There's a great case that's just come out. The state of New York has been found responsible because they did do all the right things, and they put up a poster that was a public education campaign where the model, you know, said, you know, she was facing the camera and said, "I have HIV." And she brought a defamation claim against the state and won. And going backwards, I would suspect it's because the release that she signed for the original photographer, which was then sold to Getty, which New York then got from the image from Getty, was not sufficient. And so that's why I'm always very nervous, because this takes a lot of time to suss this out. And Mike, you and I both know you want to spend about, 20 seconds on a post and move on?
On Twitter?
Yeah.
Scott writes to the show, says, just a response to the earlier discussion. If we don't want young children to use Yik Yak, then why would we encourage anyone to use it? These kinds of apps make hostility easy without providing tools to get past the hostility. It would be nice if we as a society could get over the gloss of new technology and apps that allow many different means to express oneself and instead learn to simply communicate again. That's from Scott. Mike Johansson?
I agree entirely. I mean, absolutely. But the rabbit's out of the hat, in a sense. The technology is here, and I think, just to some extent, as we've discussed, Yik Yak is doing a good job. In other words, geofencing off places where the kids can't, younger kids can't use it. But there's also some parental responsibility here too. I mean, I for the life of me cannot understand why 8, 9, 10 year olds have smartphones. And access to these things.
And picking up on that, you're seeing some internal pushback from the student users of Yik Yak. When I talk to students, I want to ask them how they use social. And I had two. One was a sophomore in college. And she said, you know, I used it when I was a freshman because it was new and I'd been geofenced out. But I quickly said, this is not as much fun. It's not very cool. It's not an enjoyable experience. And I don't use it. Same thing I asked a law student. He said, you know, it's really so negative that it was not worth it. And that is why Yik Yak is introducing a lot of these tools, because if people say, I'm not going to use it, that is the ultimate problem for any social media site, is people not using it and dropping it.
And Art wants to know if your attorney on the panel can talk more about how you would try to differentiate what is a threat and what is just racist speech. There's plenty of racist speech, and you cannot outlaw what makes people upset. That's from Art.
Yeah, and that gets right to the heart of it, in the sense of, from my perspective, you've really got to sit down and look at those definitions and work backward from the law in terms of harassment, in terms of the First Amendment, and what kinds of speech are not protected. And that is a very difficult thing to do. And oftentimes people go the absolute opposite way and say, I don't like this speech, therefore it should be banned. And that's the conundrum the universities are facing. They're seeing multiple populations find speech and see speech by others that they do not like, and they have no guarantee that it's a fellow student, and the university is being asked to restrict it. And a good example being Yik Yak. It is geography based. Nothing prevents anyone from going on the U of R campus and using the app or other apps and putting that kind of speech out into the community, or old school, doing it on paper.
Okay. We're talking social media in recent news cases with our guests for this hour. And if you want to call the program, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I'd love to know, I don't know anybody using Yik Yak, but maybe that's my age cohort. I don't think it's maybe aimed directly at me. Mike, I guess it's the younger crowd.
Yeah, and I have the app on my phone just because I want to know what kids at RIT are saying.
Well, that's your job. You've got to know this stuff.
Right. Yes. To be honest, you know, what I'm impressed with, and I this is not a fair test because I have not done this at other campuses, I'm impressed relatively by the quality of the Yaks at RIT for the most part. It seems like it reflects RIT students pretty well. There are a few immature comments there, and there are a few things you wish weren't there. But by far and away, it's more the comment on the food in the dining hall, or the fact that the heat didn't kick in fast enough in one of the residence halls. I mean, it's basically fairly neutral stuff that I've seen. I'm not looking at it all the time, and I know there probably are people doing that at RIT. I think, to your point earlier, I think it becomes somewhat of a self-regulating system. Mm-hmm. I think if enough people try it and find it to be a depressing, negative experience in a given geographic location where they spend a lot of time, they're probably going to say, not for me.
That's right. I agree with that. And part of it, too, is it's very difficult to have the discussion because we pull out examples that are far, far on the edges of the use of the app. For example, I agree with you. I see a lot of the yaks that come out, and they're mostly about homework and how it's 11:30 and the paper's due tomorrow at 8:30, and things of that nature. And so it's a very difficult to just take two or three examples and say this represents the entire app and the ecosystem. Mm-hmm.
Aaron writes to the program and says, I hate to be this negative, but Periscope is going to get sued when somebody puts a terrorist attack on Periscope. Ugh, I don't want to think about that. Yeah. But again, Mike Johansson, for the listeners who don't know what Periscope is, still relatively new.
Yeah, so it's a live streaming video app that you can literally live stream anything. And there's all kinds of issues around this, everything from copyright to a live event that's going on that other people might have had to pay to get into, that kind of thing. I mean, you can't... Theoretically, you could sit in a movie theater and live stream the opening night of Star Wars. You know, the very first screen of Star Wars, someone could Periscope it to other people who want to see it.
Scott Maloof, there's no way they'd be allowed to do that, would they?
You know, it's interesting that Mike should say that. A, George Lucas is on his way here right now for you.
I'm not suggesting you should at all. I'm just saying it is possible, right?
It is possible. And what you're seeing is the high-profile entities. So, for example, pay-per-view boxing. Pay-per-view MMF fighting or MMA fighting, you were seeing their teams are ready to go on Periscope, on Fire Chat, and these other apps to immediately send a cease and desist, a Digital Millennium Copyright Act notice, and say, take this down. And so that's what you're seeing. But then there's the whole universe below that. For example, I was at the U of R. My wife's an alum. We went to reunions, and, you know, we went to the a cappella concert, and I was using Periscope to broadcast that. You know, now, had the performers been particularly interested in copyright, absolutely they would have been interested in coming after me. So it is a bit of a problem. And that comment, generally these app providers are going to look at the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which would immunize them from any kind of lawsuit unless they really were part of that. For example, they were the ones who created the broadcast and put it out. Generally, the platforms are treated neutrally. So,
and to get back to the original point about someone being sued for broadcasting a terrorist act, would CNN or any media outlet be sued for broadcasting the footage of 9/11?
That's right.
It was live
when a lot of people were watching it. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so they're not sued. I mean, it's live. It's happening. It's real. I think where the potential might come in, not necessarily for being sued, but people being tracked down, is if people are live on Periscope during a beheading in Syria.
Oh gosh, yeah. I don't want
to. The person who's doing that is traceable through their phone.
Yeah, I think. In general, though, Aaron, I appreciate the comment, Periscope's probably not going to get sued if that happens.
No, it's probably not going to face suit for that, again, unless they were involved in the activity themselves.
Yeah, the real lawsuit question has become the people who are going to be sitting there in Star Wars theaters. And someone's going to do it, right, Mike?
They'll try, sure.
Because something like 9 billion people are going to go see Star Wars next month,
mm-hmm.
and someone's going to be sitting there Periscoping it, right?
I would probably bet a few thousand someones.
Right. And so don't you think that Star Wars or whoever is going to be sort of actively watching for that?
Disney and...
I would imagine they've already got a team of folks, particularly yeah. because that's a community that's very wired in, you know, and very technologically savvy. But again, I put the Periscope up. You know, I need to have a hashtag. I need to say Star Wars or the name of the movie. And that's instantly when, you know, this is the technology aspect. The app providers say, what's going on here? What's our responsiveness beforehand? The tools that help people find the Star Wars movie that I'm broadcasting are the same tools that would allow them to bring it down.
I don't mean to take it off into a very strange tangent here, but I follow Alan Shipnuck, a longtime golf writer, on Twitter. He was complaining about the PGA Tour. They suspended golf writer Stephanie Way because she was Periscoping practice rounds. And they were saying, no, we have exclusive ownership of the content. You can't just Periscope this stuff. And she said, do you want people to care about your product or not? I don't think you're going to shut me down. And they suspended her. And Alan Shipnuck said, I cannot believe that an organization would do that. But they said, that's our content. We have to control it. We can't just allow you to kind of go out. What are you going to display, et cetera? What do you make of that, Scott?
Well, I think that's the classic tension where you want fans, you know, if you're Star Wars, you want 9,000 people on Periscope promoting opening day of the movie. But what you don't want is losing revenue, is seeing snippets of your movie leak. For example, you know, some of the script had leaked earlier.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And so you're trying to balance that tension. And secondly, you know, if your whole contract is we're going to protect this and we're going to have this and it's exclusive, as she starts to create parallel content that is the same or similar, you're losing some of that exclusivity that somebody presumably paid for.
All right, so I didn't expect our listeners take us in directions we don't expect. All this preparation for this program, and sometimes the listeners take you in a different direction. But that's okay. Talking to Mike Johansson from RIT, a senior lecturer of communications and a social media consultant at Fixitology, and Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice focuses on the intersection of social media and the law. Short break. Let's come back and let's talk about something that does make a lot of parents uncomfortable, but this is important to talk about. Sexting, vault apps and the like, and you know, we've seen some big news stories out of Colorado is just one example. So let's take a short break and we'll talk about some of that coming up here. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, we talk to some University of Rochester students who are demanding the university get rid of Yik Yak, a social media app that has been linked to racism. They also want a racial inclusion policy. We'll talk about it and hear from the administration as well. Then second hour, what can you do to help around the holidays? We hear from more than a dozen local charities and organizations that will tell us specifics.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Studio Sales Pottery Gallery in Avon, offering holiday gifts created by local ceramic artists. Gallery hours and directions online at studiosalespottery.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Here's a story out of the New York Times, and I just want to read part of it to you to help set up what happened here in this news story. The story called The Vault Apps That Keep Sexts a Secret. And the story says, when students were caught participating in an illicit photo ring that was operating out of a high school in Canyon City, Colorado, parents and school officials there were quick to say that kind of thing was surely happening all over the country. And they're not wrong. With the growth in mobile devices, sexting has become even more prevalent than when it first received widespread attention a number of years ago. A study of several Texas high schools found that more than a quarter of the students reported having sent a naked photo of themselves, even though they were likely to report feeling bothered by being asked for one. They're following a path started by adults who report that sexting makes them feel more sexually fulfilled, according to a recent study out of Drexel University. And the question then becomes, what happens to those images? And the New York Times says, regardless of their age, many people who engage in the behavior would like to keep it a secret, and that's where the so-called vault apps come in. And the vault apps, oh man, secret calculator, folder-free, all of this stuff that I've never heard of, but I guess the purpose makes me concerned, Mike Johansson. What's the point here?
Well, it's basically a way that you can have an app on your phone that has another purpose, and if anyone catches you, it is disguised as a calculator. So it starts out looking like a calculator. You put in a series of numbers that's a code, and it turns into this photo app, sexting app. So parents would just look at their kid's smartphone and see there's a calculator app.
So even the active parent who's trying to keep an eye on what their kids are doing will just see a calculator icon.
Right. So
totally anodyne.
Right. But the really active parent should be just a tad smarter than that and not give a smartphone to a child where the child doesn't have to get their permission to download any app, period.
So you're saying your rule is child under the age of...
I think 12 and under is way too young to have a smartphone, let alone access to apps.
But even a child with an app, 13, 14, 15, 16, parent permission to get an app.
Of any kind.
Because the concern here then is, yeah, that they're hiding this. And this Canyon City stuff, this illicit photo sharing ring, that's the concern. The New York Times reports the law is trying to keep up, because the question then becomes, what about underage users? What are the legal questions here, Scott Maloof? I mean, that frightens me when I start thinking about underage users and applications like this.
I think the biggest concern for parents is going to be the prosecution for any kind of sexting, in the sense of, you know, these are underage images, and there are very stiff penalties in most states for possession of those kinds of images. And now you're looking at a situation where you've got, you know, a 15, 16, 17-year-old who is a sex offender. And that is a lifelong consequence for those folks. And so that's where, you know, the families are trying to understand what's going to happen and what is our local prosecutor, how are they going to view this? Especially because the kids, you know, they have no concept of these repercussions.
Boy. Mike Johansson, again, for parents, the New York Times has this whole section of what parents should look for. But I think you're tougher than even the Times advice is. It says really consider what's the appropriate age. I don't know what parents – my son's only 3, you know, so he knows how to swipe on a phone, but he doesn't have a phone. I don't know when parents are feeling that pressure. I'm sure it starts young. I'm sure – and the problem is, I'm sure your kid goes to school in second grade and some kid has a cell phone, and that your child comes home and wants their own cell phone. It probably starts young, that pressure, doesn't it?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure it does. I know. I mean, my daughter's 22 now, and so, you know, I'm past that age of necessarily worrying about it. But, you know, she was not allowed to sort of get on these things before she was 14. I mean...
Despite her complaints to you.
Well, yeah, but Facebook was pretty new when she was 13. So, I mean, it's like, we're, there wasn't so much pressure back then. I mean, it's got to be a lot harder today. Mm-hmm. I guess my concern is, just a few years ago, an extended family member who was a female child, I think was 9 at the time, parents divorced. The father had given the child a smartphone. Friend requested me on Facebook at age 9 or 10, and I just sent a message to the other parent and said, "I'm sorry, this is wildly inappropriate. I'm not going to be the friend of someone at that age." It's just, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking to Mike Johansson, who's the Senior Lecturer of Communications at RIT and a social media consultant at Fixitology, and Scott Maloof, an attorney focusing on social media and the law in Rochester. Every time I see Scott, I say, are there any more of you out there? Are you still the only one in town doing that?
I think in town it might be the case, but there are definitely other attorneys in the country who are doing social
media. I'm sure, because these stories come up. And part of the reason that we wanted to drag Scott and Mike back in about a month ago, we wanted to talk about this big blow up about People, P-E-E-P-L-E, which turned out, I think, to be a big nothing. But I want to work through this a little bit because there were enough headlines that people were saying, whoa, is this really happening? If you're familiar with Yelp, this was like a Yelp for human beings, and there were all kinds of questions about it. But Mike Johansson, it looks like it's not an actual thing.
Yeah, as far as we can tell, it's not an actual thing. There are people talking about it being a thing, and it's almost like people doing a trial balloon. Is there enough interest? Would people put money into this?
Balloon people, and it turned out it was a lead balloon.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, because, as much as people get excited about being able to rate things, and it is, I guess, kind of interesting, you can rate other human beings, but then, wait a minute, they're going to rate me. Uh-oh.
So all of a sudden, it's not that appealing. The outrage that I saw was, this People app would be the Yelp for neighborhoods. You get to rate your neighbors. You know, this person's a terrible neighbor. They never mow their lawn. Their dog barks too loud. Can't stand them. And people are saying, first of all, like, where does privacy come in? Second of all, where does slander or libel come in? Those were the questions I saw come up. So on the legal side of things, let's hope that this People thing never becomes a thing. Maybe it won't. But if it ever does, Scott, what are the legal questions that you would have?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is going to be that privacy expectation in the sense that, you have to have – the way it was explained was that you had to have a cell phone to get it. And so Mike, is my neighbor. He comes over. He says, hey, I'm going out of town for a week. Can you keep an eye on things? Yeah, Mike, give me your cell phone. And now theoretically I could rate Mike on the app. And so I think that strikes me as – the implicit promise that we had was, well, you're only going to use this to contact me in an emergency. But in reality, now I've taken it farther afield, and it's violating Mike's privacy. But that's really difficult in New York, because New York is not one of the states that recognizes sort of the inherent right to privacy. Other states absolutely do recognize that. I think the second problem is, it would lead to a lot of slander and defamation cases, because, people are going to, you rake the leaves and they all ended up in my yard. First thing I'm going to do is take to this app.
But is that slander? And don't you wish we all took slander and libel classes growing up?
I think, like offensiveness, people feel anything negative about them is slander, and whether it's true or not. I don't think there's a good answer to that. The answer is really it's objectivity and time. When as an attorney, if you have a legal conundrum, you always say the best thing to do is hire another attorney, because that person can look at it without the bias, without the pressure. And so that's the best thing to do. But yeah, this app was just a really bad idea. And I think Mike's right. It was probably not a balloon to say, well, let's see what comes out. The other problem is reducing people to numbers. Maybe Evan is a 4 out of 10 on raking the leaves, but otherwise he's a fantastic neighbor.
The whole rating thing. Yeah. I keep wondering if Yelp is going to go away. I thought South Park tried to kill Yelp recently with their episode making fun of it. Mike, you think Yelp's here to stay?
No, I think it's here to stay. And I think the one thing that Yelp has done, which was very smart business-wise, is it has community managers. So there's a Yelp Rochester manager I know quite well. And her job really is to smooth off the rough edges. There are people who are bad actors on Yelp. She talks to them. She gets, and they either clean up their act or they get thrown off Yelp. She talks to advertisers. She's there to be the feet on the ground for Yelp. And I think that's a really smart move. And I think that's why Yelp will survive.
Ashley writes and just says that she finds this entire conversation horrifying as a parent, and says it is so hard to stay on top of what kids are doing. And you finally feel like you get there and there are all these new things. And so she's just concerned about what some of the things she's hearing. And Mike Johansson, all right, what's the message for parents like Ashley, who's hearing all of this and is worried?
If the cat's already out of the bag and the child already has a smartphone, presumably you're paying the bill. If you're paying the bill, you have some rights. And one of your rights should be to have a lock on the ability for this individual, the child, to download anything without your approval. Period. You're paying the bill. If the child's paying the bill, then it's a matter of negotiation. But I think it's a parenting issue. It's really not the social media issue. It's you know, it's the same as the kid back in my day who used to go up and run behind the butcher shop down the street and put graffiti on the wall. I mean, you take away the paintbrushes, the kid will just go find more paintbrushes.
Mm. Who's putting cats in bags anyways, Mike?
Yeah.
That's always, I've always found that to be the strangest expression. Mike Johansson is putting cats in bags. He's the senior lecturer of communications at RIT and a social media consultant at Fixitology. Scott Maloof, a local attorney. Scott, when it comes to your kind of work, before I ask Mike about Instamom and all this, another interesting case out there, but what kind of work are you doing? We've talked about all these different angles, but your work as an attorney in social media, what's the bulk of it now?
Well, I think the two big things are helping other attorneys, especially attorneys in litigation, come up with new claims or turn Facebook posts or Yik Yak posts, things like that, into evidence. So that's one thing, and figuring out how they're going to use it in litigation. And two, working with institutions and businesses who say, we want to go on social. For example, you might want to recruit new kinds of employees. You want to use images, as Mike will tell you, to do that. And so how do we, you know, navigate through those constraints? And Mike's right. The lessons he's giving for parenting are the same ones that as a business you're going to take. You'd look at your employees and you'd say, if we provide you with this phone, we are going to monitor every app that you bring. And if you saw one of these calculator vault apps, you'd say, what's going on here? So I think that's, you know, the nature of the business is looking at those risks and then planning around them.
Can, you know, we always ask that, or people always ask that question on, can businesses dictate then? They give you a phone, a piece of technology, they can dictate what social media usage you're allowed to do?
This is an unsettled area of the law, and I know you hate that.
I find it fascinating, to be honest, because it's still in its sort of its infancy, I guess.
You're asking two questions. One is when the technology is provided by the company. And that's a pretty clear area where the company's got the right, as long as they've given the employee notice and it's in their handbook, to monitor that and to pull the technology back. That, though, is becoming a challenge because a lot of companies are saying, well, Evan, you buy your phone, we'll give you a subsidy. And now you've got this hybrid. And that's a real challenge. For example, let's say you're not doing anything nefarious, but you lose your phone. You know, XXI would say, well, Evan, the plan is to wipe it. And you go, wait a minute, I've got 500 pictures of my son on there. You know, what do we do? That's the big challenge, is how do we navigate that? Secondly, you know, the question you're asking is, what about off employment activities? Mm-hmm. And that's been a real challenge for employers. There are laws that protect you for, New York has one, for activities outside of work. But yet we haven't seen those tested vis-a-vis, for example, the employee who does post something racist and then gets fired, or the employee who puts up things that are embarrassing and the company says, we've got to let this person go. And so far the standard, you know, for folks listening, the takeaway is, you know, be aware that anything you post on social, if it does reflect negatively on your employer, their incentive is going to be to find a way to remove you. And unless you have other protections like a disability, like a contract, like union rights, you know, you may find yourself on the wrong end of being fired.
Daniel writes and says he's enjoying the conversation about all the things social media gets wrong. He said, did you see Fox News get conned about the Eiffel Tower after Paris? I think what he's referring to, and somewhere in my stack of notes is here. So after the Paris attacks, somebody was spreading this image of the Eiffel Tower. It was dark. The lights were off, saying, wow, you know, such a show of solidarity. First time the Eiffel Tower has been dark since 1889. And, you know, apparently some Fox Twitter accounts were saying, you know, wow, first time Eiffel Tower dark since 1889. The Eiffel Tower goes dark every night at 1 a.m. That's not a big deal. I guess the person who posted that intentionally did it to see who would pick it up. And that's a fascinating idea. That always scares me that people are using social media as an experiment. Jimmy Kimmel apparently does these fake viral videos to see, or videos to see if they go viral. But Mike, that goes back to what you said earlier this hour, which is, you know, check your sources and be careful on what you're trusting that gets shared on social media.
Right, fact checking. I mean, it's a simple thing to look at something and say, oh, that's funny, that's interesting, reshare, retweet, whatever. But the fact of the matter is, you don't check your brain at the door when you're on social media. I mean, that's the problem. It's not that the social media has any issues. It's the people using it are just not thinking like they should, I guess.
Sure. And so Daniel's story on the Eiffel Tower, that's one where logic should have helped us realize that. There was another story that was shared a lot on social that turned out not to be accurate, that I even shared this saying, I don't know that this is true. I'm sharing it on the hope it was true. It turned out not to be true. It was the story on the night of the Paris attacks of one of the attackers who had a bomb tried to get into the Stade de France to get into the soccer match, and was not able to get in. And the person who sort of the guard who witnessed and saw it and kind of called other police and brought it to attention was a Muslim. He was observing all of this and then called authorities in. He was not the guard who kind of, wrestled or grappled with the guy or noticed it. But one of the common memes after that was, for all the criticism of Muslims, it was a Muslim guard who stopped this attacker. It turned out not exactly to be accurate, and it was a really hopeful story. But it doesn't mean, obviously, it's not a commentary on Islam at all. It's just one isolated case. But, Mike, that's another case where I looked and I went, oh, I'm trying to vet this. I really hope it's a beautiful story. Turned out not to be true. And it's easy to see how fast that spreads. It's amazing.
And it's usually the things that people hope are true that get spread the
and
fastest.
And I was one of them, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you get all these hopeful stories. That, mm-hmm. There was just something I shared today about a survivor of the Holocaust. And it was such a touching video. It was such a, and there was French being translated into English. I thought, I hate to be this skeptical, but I do have to check it out. So I checked it out. It turned out to be true. So I shared it.
Okay. At least you trust yeah. but verify.
Right, exactly.
And that point about speed, that goes to the average user, and that's what we're seeing. So often people in the worst moments of their lives or in really stressful situations will post things to social, and that's when the repercussions come. And so the real thing to take away is not how does Twitter work or Yik Yak. It's, take your mobile phone and maybe wait a bit before you do something.
Brian, let me back it up here. Brian on Twitter is asking, are these students really asking the university to censor its internet connection? Do they know how phones work? He's talking about, again, going back to the University of Rochester, a conversation we're going to have in the first hour tomorrow. Students complaining to the university about Yik Yak, which is a social media app that has been essentially anonymous and the home for a good amount of racist kind of posting. But Scott, Brian just kind of wants to know exactly what are they asking, what's realistic? He's saying, are these students really asking the university to censor its internet connection?
Well, I think the better reporting, because I haven't seen the actual raw letter from the students, and that would be the most helpful. But what they're asking, and we've seen other schools do this, is to say you block Yik Yak from their infrastructure, their Wi-Fi network and their servers, because it doesn't reside there. You're just using it as a pass-through to get there. And he's right. His point is, yeah, they'll just go, as Mike said, to the cellular network. That's exactly what will happen.
Would it be more symbolic? I mean, if students really want to be on Yik Yak then, Mike, is it sounding like there's not a way to stop them?
No, we go back to that geofencing thing. U of R just has to put up a sort of an electronic fence around the campus and say Yik Yak cannot be used on the campus. That would be literally the only way to stop it.
All right. Well, we'll find out tomorrow in our first hour when we welcome a couple of administrators from the University of Rochester in to help us understand what they're seeing about this issue. And I know that they are trying to respond very proactively to the student concerns about Yik Yak, but also some other issues. And that'll be in the first hour tomorrow.
And just picking up on the geofence, and I was thinking about that, U of R is a good example where you've got an extensive medical facility. Well, we've had the National Labor Relations Board say that you can use social media to discuss your workplace conditions, your wage and hour, how you're treated, safety, things like that. So in theory, if the school said, well, we're going to geofence and you can't use Yik Yak, you can't use these other platforms, workers could come forward and say, well, I use those platforms to whistleblow. I use those platforms to discuss my terms and conditions of work. And so you can't, by law, geofence it. And that's a great example of the stress for the university, especially someplace densely packed, is there's no one answer that works for every community.
Okay. Bill, an email from Bill saying, thanks for this great hour. Very interesting. Did the Charlie Tan trial include any social media evidence? Not that I know of, but I don't know. I wasn't there every day. Scott, do you know of any?
I didn't hear of any. But that said, there was a really active Twitter stream, Tan trial. You saw, I know you've had John Hand on, mm-hmm. and John was really good. Gary Craig is another local reporter, yep. who is really good on Twitter. And you're seeing a lot of that in the sense of reporters are double dutying. They're in the trial, they're looking at it, and they're also out tweeting. And that's really changing sort of how the community is interacting with these cases. But as to his question, that social media evidence is becoming bigger and bigger in cases. Obviously, family law, a lot of evidence in family law. Employment, it's becoming a bigger thing. Your star salesperson leaves, and so we're starting to walk backwards and say, well, what LinkedIn connections did they have? Where are the messages they're sending? Back to the device. If I were the employee who wanted to exfiltrate information information, boy, the Vault app might look really cool, even on my workplace-issued phone, because I'm hoping I can slide it under the notice.
Do you suspect prosecutors at least looked into what Charlie Tan had posted on Facebook and various social media accounts?
I mean, I have no knowledge of what they did or didn't do, but I would imagine that's got to be start of their standard repertoire.
Sure.
Departments have internet officers, you know, and we've seen that come up in cases where, you know, Instagram posts have led to arrests for weapons possessions in other parts of the country.
All right, so I've only got a minute left here. I want to squeeze in the Instamom. Mike Johansson, what is the Instamom?
The Instamom are these people who are posting hundreds, if not thousands, of images of their very, very young children because they're cute, because every time they post a picture of cute little Sarah or cute little John, they get lots of likes. The downside to this, of course, is that you're making your child a limited public figure forever and ever and ever. And that means that you're actually helping them give up some of their rights to privacy forever and ever and ever. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. It's the same if you agree that your child can be a child model and they appear in catalogs and they appear in magazines and they get photographed all over the place, they are really, truly not entitled. And Scott probably knows this law better than I, but I'm working off media law. They're giving up some of their rights to privacy. And, you know, they become, in some sense, a limited public figure.
And my guess is parents are not thinking about that. 20 seconds, Scott, what would you say there?
I would agree with that, and I would agree. You know, there is also the fact that New York, California have laws protecting students or children who are actors, who are models. New York's law so far doesn't seem to have protected, you know, the Instamom kids, but that could be coming. So you may have to take 15% of what you earn, put it in trust for that kid.
Wow. We worked through a lot of different issues this hour, got through a lot of your questions on social media, and our thanks to our guests, because this has just been one of those just kind of stretches of time where there's a lot out there. We didn't even get a chance to ask about, I got another question that maybe for another day on this group, Anonymous, kind of going after ISIS and...
And students at Harvard and MIT actually tackling them on social media, using social media to get after them.
See, I don't... Look at all the things you learn when Mike and Scott are here. Thank you, Mike Johansson from RIT, senior lecturer and social media consultant at Fixitology. Always nice to see you.
Likewise.
Scott Maloof, online where, Scott Maloof?
At www.scottmaloof.com and on Twitter, of course.
MALOUF. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Val LaBanca, the engineer of the program, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon.